All right, let's be real. What has been the hardest thing about your pregnancy and postpartum journey? Is it the postpartum painful sex that nobody talks about? What are you supposed to do with that? Is it the fact that you might have torn during delivery and you have no idea how to heal now that you're in postpartum? Welcome to the Onas podcast, where we bring on mothers, parents, and pregnant postpartum individuals to talk about their journey and their experiences to give that knowledge back to people that need it. And we are also attached to theonascollaborative.com, which is a free online educational directory where we help moms and parents connect to maternity care providers in their local area. We are here to give the power back to you guys so you have a choice in your journey. We'll have space for midwives, doulas, pelvic floor PTs, massage therapist. And as we continue expanding, we hope that we can support you. All right, we hope you enjoy this podcast. Welcome back to the Onas podcast. My name is Erin and I am your host and also the founder of the Onas Collaborative. Today we have such an exciting episode. I just loved doing this one. So it's actually with Kayla. She is out of North Carolina and she is going to be talking to us about her three very, very different birth experiences. So she's going to be talking to us about working, you know, with a hospital birth, birthing center, and even a home birth. It was such an exciting episode and we'll actually be breaking this into two parts. This is the first part and then you will get the second part next week. So I hope you all enjoy.
Sure. So I'm Kayla and I live with my husband, Sam, and our 3.5-year-old daughter, our 2-year-old son, and our 8-week-old son in Huntersville, North Carolina, which is really close to Charlotte. And as of right now, I'm a stay-at-home mom as a result of COVID. You know, before this, I was a marketing coordinator for a hemp company in North Carolina and they went bankrupt because of COVID. So I invested all my time and energy in just being a stay-at-home mom. And that's kind of where I've landed myself, is taking care of all the little people.
I love that. So there was actually a little hemp company in Charlotte.
Yeah. Well, it was more like a North Carolina-based company and they had a lot of different retail stores all over the place. We hadn't quite come to Charlotte yet, that there was a place who was about to start opening, but when COVID happened and the world shut down, they never ended up going through with it. So yeah.
Well, at least now you get to stay home with the kids as long as that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's been great. And pretty much with every time I've had a baby, I've stayed at home for a good period of time and then went back into work. This was an opportunity where I was able to work from home and be a stay-at-home mom at the same time. So it was crazy busy, but a lot of fun to still like have something outside of just being a mom too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so today our discussion is actually about your birth. So you have three kids, you've had a hospital, a birthing center birth, and a home birth, all completely different types of experiences.
Yeah.
I'm actually just going to let you go ahead and jump in and let us know, you know, the differences that you've noticed, why you decided to change from one to the other and your story. So go for it.
Sure. Yeah. So with my daughter, we were, you know, pretty young and honestly, I didn't really spend much time thinking or learning about birth. You know, where I come from, which is a really small town, you just do birth one way and that's have an OB and have a hospital birth. And actually this is a little bit of a twist. So I was pregnant and 34 weeks. And my OB that I was seeing, I noticed that when he did a pelvic exam and I noticed that when he did that, it got really uncomfortable. And later that day I noticed blood and turns out he later admitted that he did a sweep on me at 34 weeks, wow, which I thought was pretty crazy. And actually, so the twist in the story is at that point in time, I decided to try to change to a birthing center birth. So I know initially I mentioned that I had a hospital birth first, but I was planning on it, but I actually ended up having a birth center birth first. And so I switched at 37 weeks to midwives because I was like, that was crazy. You know, it was against my consent. And I felt like the whole time that my care wasn't really quality. Yeah. And so I had heard of this birth center and connected with them and they were able to get me in. And then I did all this education in the last several weeks of pregnancy on natural birthing and just all this, you know, stuff that I had not spent time or had not felt like I had access to because, you know, no one tells you this stuff unless you go looking for it. So it was 41 and 4 and I finally went into labor and I ended up having a successful birthing center birth, but I did push for about 5 hours. And so when I had my daughter, she was having a little trouble breathing from being in the birth canal for so long. So we were transferred to a hospital at that point. Both of us were, because I actually had some pretty significant blood loss from pushing so long. And then, I also had a pretty significant tear from pushing so long. So I had to go be stitched up in the hospital. And then, she had to be in the NICU for 24 hours and, you know, it ended up being totally fine. Like within a couple hours of her being at the hospital, she was able to completely breathe on her own. They didn't have to do anything crazy to help her do and function as a normal newborn, but as a protocol for the hospital, she had to stay in the NICU for 24 hours. So I remember, like, after getting stitched up, like waddling to the NICU every 2 hours and nursing her, and
wow.
You know, being at the hospital at that point was good in some ways, because you know, I felt like in some ways that was a traumatic experience. She had to be transferred by ambulance to the hospital. But in a lot of ways, I felt like there was a big lack of support for me as a new mom. Like, I'll never forget my daughter's first latch after being separated from her for 6 hours, because I had to go and be stitched up by a surgeon. She had to go to the NICU. And, you know, again, no one tells you how to do this stuff. And so when I was trying to get her to latch, I was just struggling so hard, couldn't figure it out. And it felt like no one was there as a resource to help me. They couldn't get a lactation consultant to come to NICU. Fortunately, there was this one nurse who just kind of was like, I've been here for so long, I can help you figure it out. And she was probably my saving grace that whole time. Mm-hmm. So we did end up finally getting a successful latch, but it wasn't for a lack of trying.
Wow.
Yeah. So then we were there for probably about 36 hours after that. She was able to be released from the NICU to our room after 24 hours. And then, you know, from there, it was pretty much just round the clock checking on both of us, which I appreciated as a new mom, but also you get no sleep when you're in a hospital. They have no mercy. You know, you're getting constant providers in your room, nonstop, someone checking on you, someone checking on baby, a different person checking on baby, a different person running a test, a nurse bringing you your vitamins. It's just nonstop. And there's really no true rest. Mm-hmm. And you feel like they try to cram pack this education of how to be a mom in these 48 hours. And then you go home and you're like, what just happened?
Yeah.
So I feel like there's really no continuity of care in that regard. When we went home, it was pretty smooth sailing, except for breastfeeding was really hard. We ended up finally figuring it out after I reached out to a lactation consultant in the area, and she helped us do a weighted feed, and I discovered the breast friend, and that changed the game for me for nursing. And, you know, it just took a lot of work. I'll never forget the moments of my husband and I just sitting in the glider rocker, and I'm just crying, asking him to help me figure this out, you know. And again, there's just, people just don't talk about this stuff, and no one really helps moms once they leave a hospital unless they reach out for help, which is so sad to me. Yeah. So I was very fortunate that I knew about a lactation consultant at that point and reached out to them and got that breastfeeding relationship fixed. And then after that, we really didn't have any problems, you know, with breastfeeding, and I breastfed her for a pretty long time. But I knew, you know, going into my second birth experience that I wanted this to be completely different from my first. Like, I didn't want to, you know, have to change providers so late in the game. I didn't want, you know, to have birth trauma this time around necessarily. So I did a lot of education for myself. I sought out a lot of resources, and I decided going into my second birth that I was going to start at the birth center that I ended at last time. Okay. I thought maybe, you know, if I had like the full pregnancy experience with them, that the outcome would have been even better. So I started with them with my second pregnancy, and I should add that, you know, that was about, I'm going to say I got pregnant 14 months after having my daughter with my son. So pretty soon after, you know, having a 1-year-old and getting pregnant, and, we had pretty much planned him, but I actually had an IUD after my daughter and ended up perforating my uterus. And I had to have surgery to have it removed. Oh, and I feel like that's a really important part of the story, because the OB who put it in after he put it in, I was in terrible pain. I was bleeding. My legs were going numb. And I went to him like begging him, please check it. Something is wrong. And he actually told me that I was being a wimp. Yeah, I'm not kidding. He told me that I was being a wimp and that, you know, it's going to be painful. It takes a while for, you know, it to really settle into place. And that's so crazy because I just had a baby completely unmedicated. And this pain was so unexplainable and so different and so much worse than labor. And fortunately I went to the same birthing center that I had my daughter and they were so kind. The midwives there listened to me, they heard me and they fought for me. I mean, they went to bat trying to, you know, figure this out. And they said, we will figure this out. You will not continue to be in pain anymore. So we went through ultrasound and x-ray and finally they found it. And then they referred me to their OB practice that they partner with. And that is the person who ended up taking out my IUD for me. And so we were expecting to be pregnant within the near future, but we thought, you know, because of just having had that surgery that it might take a little bit longer and it did not. I was pretty much pregnant right after I had that surgery. I had that surgery right before my daughter turned one. And then by the time she was about 14 months, I was pregnant with my son. So just always feel like that's an important part to share because I mean, it just goes to show that different providers will advocate for you differently and some providers will take you serious and some won't. And it's important for us as women to advocate for ourselves and to find people that will listen to us and take us seriously. I mean, it's just so crazy how I feel like we forget oftentimes that we're paying these providers and this is their job, you know, and we're paying them to do us a service and it's every right of ours to ask and to expect of them whatever we feel keeps us sane and helps us feel heard and safe.
Exactly. So a lot of people think that they work for the provider. Like, no, the provider works for you.
Yes, exactly.
For their service.
Yeah. Anytime I hear something like my provider is letting me do this, I'm like, okay, let's talk about what that means. Your provider is letting you do something or you're choosing that with them educating you and giving you options, you know, like, and if they're making decisions for you and they're not decisions that you support, it's time to fire your provider.
Yeah. Like I've had, because I suffer from endometriosis. So within the endo community. And so girls will be like, my doctor won't allow me to. Like, wait.
Yeah. I'm like, oh.
Wait, say that again.
You make decisions for your body. And if they don't like it, that's one thing. But at the end of the day, you have the final say.
Exactly. So we're on the same page. And after all of this, I have a lot of questions. I'm like making my notes. So
you can keep for sure. Yeah. No. And whenever you need me to stop, I'm here. So, okay. So with my son, so got pregnant with him, started with that birth center and just completely different care. I mean, you're talking the appointments are twice and sometimes almost four times as long because the thing about midwifery care is the education piece. You know, a lot of time OBs, they're very straight to business and this is not discrediting them. I've had a lot of great OBs in my life who have been wonderful to me, but around OB care, the difference and, you know, prenatal care, the difference is just education. You know, the midwives are here to educate you, to help you think about the whole person, the whole woman, and not just you're carrying a fetus and that's it. So started with them, thought that they were wonderful. Then around 24 weeks, we were visiting with family and I managed to fall down some steps, blame it on my body just being disproportionately large. I don't know. And we were visiting family in Canada, which is obviously not where I live. So I got to check out the healthcare system there, which is quality. Not something I wanted to do while on vacation, but, you know, something I needed to do. So after I fell, I was having a lot of contractions and felt just super uncomfortable. And turns out I had a subchorionic hematoma. So I ended up spending Christmas Eve in the hospital and, you know, they just managed me for a while and watched me and I was able to go home and that was all fine. And the time I was a teacher and I had to take 8 weeks off of work for moderated bed rest. So, you know, could still do things around the house, but should not be actively standing all day or walking around and doing all those things just to make sure the bleed didn't get worse or expand. And because it looked like my placenta was trying to tear away from the uterine wall. So was taking it pretty easy. And then when I, right when I went back to work, which is about 34 weeks, I started getting really itchy and on my hands and my feet in particular. And I remember talking to this midwife and she was like, you know, that sounds like it could be cholestasis. And I was like, no, I don't think it's that severe. You know, like I'm probably just swelling. I'm getting bigger. And she was like, you know, she was like, I hear you. And I know you, you think it's fine, but I think we should just do this test just to be safe.
Yeah.
And I was like, ah, okay. You know, I'll do it. That's fine. So we did the blood test for cholestasis and I had to wait like 5 days before I got the results and talk about being on the edge of your seat, you know, not knowing what's going on. And about 5 days later, they called me and they were like, oh, your test results came back and they were fine. Don't worry. And I was like, great. I was like, but I'm still itchy. This is weird. And then not even kidding, 15 minutes later, they called me. Well, actually MFM called me, which is maternal fetal medicine, trying to schedule this ultrasound. And I thought that was really strange.
Yeah.
And then I called the birth center. And I was like, wait a minute, you guys told me my results were fine. Like, what's going on? And they were like, well, actually, there was a misread in your results. We were reading your results as if you weren't pregnant, but for pregnancy, you fall into the place of having cholestasis, and we need to have you further evaluated by MFM. Wow. So my head just kind of was spinning. I remember feeling really overwhelmed, just thinking, wait, how did we go from 10 minutes ago not having it to like now having it, you know, and was still itching at this point. So I kind of expected something might be off, but was trying not to think too much about it. So ended up having my MFM appointment and they confirmed that I had cholestasis, but that my son was growing fine and not necessarily to worry about his growth at that point, but that I would definitely need to be induced. Yeah. So that was really discouraging because here I am spending this entire time planning this completely different birth plan from my first pregnancy, you know, planning to have a beautiful, redeeming birth center birth. And then, you know, to kind of have this curveball thrown at you that, you know, not only do you have to change your care again in late pregnancy, but you have to completely change your birth plan. And now you're going to have a hospital birth. Yeah. So essentially what happened was the birth center handed off my care to their partnering OB. And to kind of go back, this is the same OB who removed my IUD. Mm-hmm. So I did have a relationship with them. So I didn't feel completely unfamiliar, but still was really frustrated and discouraged by this and just felt so heavy. There's like no other way to describe it than to like, you know, have all this happen. And then for them to also tell you, now you have to come and do non-stress tests twice weekly. And now you have to have the biophysical profiles more regularly. And you're going to be induced between 36 and 37 weeks. And, you know, just learning even what cholestasis means, which for those who don't know, is basically where your liver isn't properly producing, or I don't even know, dealing with bile, and it's basically dumping it into your bloodstream, which is what causes the itching.
Yeah.
And that can also contaminate the baby's blood. And then it can stop their heartbeat spontaneously, typically after 37 weeks, which is why they recommend a 37 week induction. And I did not know that. So that's why I felt like it was really important to share that, because I had no idea that that was even a thing until it was happening to me. So I want to say it was again, 34 weeks. So at that point, my care was transferred and I was going twice weekly for NSTs. And then I think like once a week BPPs. And then I was having my bile acids labs drawn like twice weekly to check it. I was on ursodiol, the highest dosage that you could possibly do as a pregnant woman. And they just really couldn't control it. It was just kind of crazy how they couldn't get my bile acids to just come down. But my doctor felt sure because my NSTs were doing great, you know, that I could be induced at least at 37 weeks. So we shot for 37 weeks and by 37 and four, I was able to be induced. Mm-hmm. The induction was pretty great. I should mention, I didn't have a doula in my first pregnancy. And I, again, wanting to do completely everything different with the second pregnancy, we did hire a doula and she was wonderful. When I went in for the induction, I had no cervical changes at all. So I had to have Cervidil. We did two doses of that to get my cervix to ripen up. And by the time that was all said and done, I was only 2 centimeters dilated. So they did start Pitocin at that point. And that was just mind-blowing to me. My body did not react well to the Pitocin at all. And I just had like I don't even know. I mean, the contractions are pretty much nonstop back to back, which I'm sure you probably hear this a lot of anyone who's ever had an induction. Pitocin's pretty relentless. And my legs started shaking and I felt like I couldn't stand up. Like it was just crazy how different it was from a spontaneous labor. And then I want to say I was like on my hands and knees and all of a sudden there was like this just gush of blood. And I kind of panicked because I was like, what is going on? And I had a relatively new nurse and she was like, I've never seen anything like this. Like I need to go get, you know, a nurse who's been here longer than me to help me figure out what's going on. So talk about words of reassurement. Like yeah, it wasn't, yeah, it wasn't exactly like the most comforting thing ever to hear. The nurse came in and she checked me and she was like, listen, you're fine. She was like, it's just your cervix is changing so quickly that it's bleeding. And that just kind of caught me off guard. And, you know, at that point, I think I kind of shut down. Like I felt scared and I don't know, just unsure of everything in that moment. And again, the contractions were so back to back and I just felt like I couldn't get through it anymore. So I did opt for an epidural at that point. And I should also add, I have really low blood pressure. Like my resting blood pressure is 90 over 50. So I remember just telling them, please, please make sure that you do whatever you have to do to keep my blood pressure up. Like, I don't want to pass out.
Yeah.
You know, and they pumped like 2 full bags of fluid in me. And they were like, this is how we're going to keep your blood pressure up. It was just crazy. And once I got the epidural, I did feel pretty good. I was able to just kind of relax a little bit. I didn't feel that super crazy, you know, intense situation with the contractions coming on really hard. I mean, I still could feel the tightening and the pressure, but I couldn't feel the pain or the discomfort. So after that, they decided, well, since you have your epidural, we're going to put a peanut ball between your legs and lay you on your left side. And it was not even 45 minutes later. And I was like, I need to throw up. And I did. And then after that, I was like, and I think this baby's head is like coming out. Wow. Like, this is just crazy. And the nurse came in and she was like, yep, you're definitely ready to have this baby. And it's just crazy how fast it was. It was like the second that I was able to just relax, like my body just, you know, dilated so quickly, because I think I went from like a 5 when the nurse had last checked me when all the bleeding happened to, you know, 45 minutes later being fully effaced and fully dilated and ready to have a baby.
Yeah.
So at that point we did practice pushes because again, I had an epidural, which I did have them turn off so I could still feel the pushing. Mm. And, on my second practice push, my water exploded all over my nurse. She was soaking wet and she literally looked at myself, my doula, my husband, was like, I'm so sorry. I have to go and change. And I mean, poor girl, she had to go take a shower. She was so wet. I felt so terrible, but it was kind of that moment where I just like was able to laugh off everything that had happened before, because what are the odds, you know, that something like that would happen. And I'll never forget at this point, the OB on call came in and he was like, well, you know, if you need to push, you just do it. You just push. And that's exactly what I did. I mean, there was no one in there helping us. It was my doula and my husband and myself. And I was pushing this baby out. All of a sudden, right before my son's head finally came out, the midwife swooped in and about 50 other people. I don't even know who those people were. You know, there's always a team that comes in when you're at a hospital. And they didn't catch the baby. My midwife actually said, do you want to pull your baby out? And so I did. Oh. And so she didn't even end up touching him. So that was kind of crazy. And it happened slow and fast all at the same time. Like once the epidural happened, everything just happened so quickly. And I just will never forget that OB coming in and saying, if you need to push, just do it. So I did. And then he was born. And a lot of times with cholestasis, those babies tend to have to go to the NICU. But fortunately, my son came out 7 pounds, 4 ounces and thriving. So was pretty lucky in that case. So he did not have to go to the NICU. And again, we had a dreadful hospital stay. And I say that because we were already super tired from having a 24-hour induction. you know, not having much sleep and lots of work. And then it just felt like we could not get any rest. There was always someone in our room, you know, just doing all the odds and ends things. And I should say too, as much as I have had decent hospital experiences, they don't take care of the dads. Like my poor husband slept on this terrible cardboard cot basically, and they only provide food for moms. So he had to leave every single meal and go get food for himself because they wouldn't provide him with food, which I thought was super strange. He do meals for moms, and he could go downstairs and go to the kitchen and get his own food, but they, I mean, essentially he had to leave to go. So I would be interested, you know, especially with COVID, a lot of people aren't even allowed to leave their room. So I would be so curious to see what people are doing for their husbands or their dads, you know? So we did make sure to pack a lot of snacks because we had heard that that was the case, but still, you know, you think about, you've just been through this really strenuous labor, and he was my support the entire time. So he's just as exhausted as I am, even though his body didn't quite go through the same changes, but, you know, needing to nourish our bodies to be quality parents. And, you know, they don't think about the dads or take care of the dads. And it's crazy to me because the hospital bill that you get at the end of it should reflect taking care of the dads.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. So I always found that to be really interesting. But yeah, so after a couple of days, we were, you know, released from the hospital and went home, and everything was great. But we quickly noticed that my son looked a little yellow and he seemed a little bit jaundiced. And he did end up having jaundice, but he didn't have to go back to the hospital or have a bilirubin blanket or anything like that. It turned out it was breast milk jaundice or breastfeeding jaundice. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of it, but apparently it's, you know, it's kind of like your child has this milk protein allergy and it takes them a while with breastfeeding, I guess, to process it. This is just how our pediatrician described it to us. So essentially after a couple of weeks, it went away on its own. We just kept breastfeeding through it. And, you know, eventually it went away and he didn't need any additional care, but it was definitely a stressful time because we still had to take him to a hospital to be tested. Cause you know, they do like this little scan on their forehead and that tells them some numbers, but it's not necessarily that accurate. So once his numbers kept coming back pretty high, they made us go to this children's hospital and have him, like, his blood tested for jaundice levels. And it came back elevated, but they didn't feel like it was concerning enough to, like, admit him to the hospital. So that was a pretty stressful couple weeks, just going through all of that. And then he had really terrible reflux issues. So for the first 2 months of his life, I had to sleep with him, like, I was sitting up in the bed holding him upright, because if we laid him down, he would literally choke on spit up. Wow. So that was such a nightmare for me because my daughter did not spit up at all ever. So it was just such a different experience altogether. And it ended up that he had a dairy allergy, which was an additional stressor because, you know, I have obviously eaten dairy my whole life and had no idea how it could impact a baby. And at the time I thought he had colic, and my pediatrician recommended that we test him for a dairy allergy because she said, you know, new research has shown that a lot of people who think their babies have colic, it turns out that they actually have a milk protein allergy. So we ended up testing a poop diaper, and it came back with microscopic blood in it. And that is how we knew that he had a dairy allergy, which I thought was really interesting because I never would have known that unless, again, it happened to me. So I had to cut dairy out of my diet in order to continue to breastfeed him. And that was so hard. I don't think you know how hidden dairy can be until you have to completely eliminate it. And I don't, it can be so discouraging. Like, for example, it takes 2 months to completely eliminate dairy from your diet. And that's being 100% cold turkey, dairy free. And anytime that you eat any bit of dairy, it kind of starts that process over. He was having bad diaper rashes. He was having skin problems. He was crying a lot, just seemed super uncomfortable. All the acid reflux, terrible smelling sour poops. It was so hard. And again, completely different from my daughter. So once I finally got rid of dairy out of my diet, things improved a lot. Like, his poops got better, his skin got better, his fussiness got better. He still had reflux, but it wasn't nearly as bad. And it did not require medication because It was mostly just more just milk that he had just eaten rather than milk that had been digested. So that was definitely nice. But what happened from all of this is from the stress of cholestasis, the, you know, complete change of the birth plan, then all this stuff that happened with him in the beginning, it sent me into postpartum depression. And not the kind, and I think people think of postpartum depression as, I don't love my baby, I can't connect. And that wasn't really it at all. And maybe it was more postpartum anxiety looking back on it, but it was more like, I need to stay busy and do all the things all the time because I can't be at rest for fear of thinking of something that something's bad's going to happen, or, you know, how I'm not being enough as a mom. And I did end up seeking therapy for it. And I went to therapy for about 4 months. I did end up getting on medication to help just regulate my brain. And honestly, it helped me so much. And I'm not sure I would have made it through that time without the therapy and the medication. And we did, it was, you know, we planned it with my therapist as like a short term, just to kind of help me get back regulated and get my emotions regulated. And then I did come off of it. And I was able to breastfeed the whole time. It was completely breastfeeding safe. But, you know, I mean, postpartum depression can happen to people with even the most perfect stories and the most perfect outcomes. But I definitely think for me, there was just so much going on in that moment. And then those times just, I don't even know. It just sent me into this tailspin of postpartum depression. And I just think that's something that's not talked about enough. And there's definitely not enough support around that. And I'm fortunate enough that my husband is really in tune with me and he can really tell when things are off. And he was really encouraging to me to talk to my provider about the things that I was experiencing. And then she was really encouraging to me to connect me with a therapist who then helped me work through this and give me coping strategies to deal with things when I feel these intense depressive or, you know, anxiety spells coming on. So I battled with that for about 6 to 8 months in total after he was born. So this first, you know, good chunk of his life, I felt like I was just, it was such a blur in some ways, you know, it was just getting through every day, trying to like still love myself at the end of it and still be the best mom that I could be. So again, when you're thinking about all these things that happened going into my third pregnancy, I just wanted it to be completely different, you know, even the postpartum depression aspect. So, let's see where to begin. So when we got pregnant with my third baby, COVID had pretty much just happened.
We want to thank Kayla so much for coming on. It's so exciting for this first part, and our next part will actually be on her home birth with her son. And if you're interested in reaching out to Kayla, you can find her at Kayla_D_Steinberg. So super exciting, and we're just so appreciative that she was willing to come on here and share her experience through all of her different pregnancies. They were also different, but I think there's so much value in what we can hear from her and other people's stories. So we will see you all next week for Kayla's part 2.